Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is the podcast where we do our best to keep you caught up on everything that's going on in the world. Maybe you're busy, maybe you just don't have time to pay attention, maybe you just choose not to. All of those things I respect. You are entitled to live whatever life you choose, as long as you're not hurting anybody else. And yeah, I hope you're feeling good. We've got a really good news catch up today. Loads of different stories to talk about. Lots of good stuff from GAA Sports. You can imagine my eye roll there, to the absolutely heartbreaking attack on people in Sydney. And of course, we will be discussing Iran throwing some bombs Israel's direction. Lots of different things to discuss. But before we get into it, how was your weekend? I hope it was good. I hope you had a good one. Hope you did fun stuff. If not, don't worry. They can't all be good. I had a very good one. I was a very lucky girl indeed. I was invited to go to Knockranny House Hotel, which is in Westport. It's about 15 minutes walk into the centre of Westport in Mayo. And I had actually gone to see Romy in London on Thursday night. So it was kind of hectic, but good. Then we drove down to Knockranny on Friday and had this amazing food weekend where it was all about like a celebration of lamb, really. And we got to eat delicious lamb cooked by the chef at the Knockranny House Hotel, who is amazing. And the hotel itself is great. Like, I like a classic Irish hotel. I like a fancy modern hotel as well, but I also like a classic hotel. Lovely big rooms. The views from the hotel are just spectacular. Like, big, giant. If you look at my Instagram, you'll see there were just amazing views. Everywhere you ate or drank, there was amazing views. And the food was just so good. But we also went to this farm, Glenkeen Farm, which was about, that's my phone as I'm trying to make sure that I get all the details right, which was about 45 minutes, I think, away from Knockranny. And it's a farm you can go and visit. And we had this amazing lesson in sheep herding. So we learned all about how you train a sheepdog. It was a border collie, was the one who we met. Jan was her name. All about how you train her to help you herd the sheep and how it works. And an amazing demonstration. We learned about wool spinning, and we saw great music. It was just amazing. It was a really nice reminder, I think, if you live in Dublin, as I do, and I have lived outside of Dublin. I lived in Galway for 3.5 years. I there's loads of different parts of Ireland that I absolutely love, but sometimes I think you can get a bit embroiled in Dublin. And at the moment, the kind of Dublin vibe is, I would say, not as strong as it normally is. It's great to get out and just remember that there's so much more to Ireland, and there's such beautiful people and beautiful places and gorgeous scenery. And sometimes I think when we hear people talking about Ireland, tourists talking about Ireland in glowing terms, you forget that, yeah, there are such wonderful experiences all around the country. That's not to shit on Dublin. I just don't think we're in our best era at the moment. So it was just a stunning weekend, and I feel very grateful for it and very kind of heartened, for want of a better phrase. And that was it, really. Just got some good kid time in, obviously, when we came home. Looking forward to going back to being Velcro Mom this week. So, anywho, let's get into the news. As I said, there was a lot to discuss, lots of different things, lots of interesting things to chat about. So let's get you all caught up with Carl Kinsella. Well, good morning, Carl Kinsella. How are you? How was your weekend?
Good morning, Louise McSharry. My weekend was good. I actually spent the entirety of it just holed up in my room, finishing my final assignment, like my final non-thesis assignment.
Okay.
So I feel like I was like living. I feel like I was. You know the bit in Lord of the Rings where Sméagol sort of deteriorates into Gollum. That's sort of how I was starting to feel. But yeah, no, it's all done now.
Oh, it's rough, man. It's rough. I'm glad that you're getting there. I'm happy for you. I couldn't do it. I know I've said it before.
I heard it's very, very rainy back home. Is that true?
It's actually beautiful outside now as I speak to you, but it was certainly a weekend of many seasons. I was actually in Mayo for the weekend, just outside Westport, and the weather was changeable, but beautiful. I was in this gorgeous hotel, Knockranny House, which has just huge windows overlooking like Croagh Patrick, and yeah, it was really nice. So I have
I
no
need
complaints.
That holiday, Louise. I need to book myself a weekend away.
You should. And if you need a recommendation for a peaceful place in Ireland, I've got many, so just come to me and I will give that to you. Okay, well, we've got a lot to talk about, quite a diverse range of things to talk about this week, actually. And I suppose I think it's good to address this head on, the Iran attacks on Israel, what that means, why that happened, all of that kind of stuff. Because I think a lot of people were like quite shook by this.
Yeah, and I was pretty shook by it as well. Mm. It's I think probably the first thing to note is that Iran's attack, which happened on Saturday night, it was in retaliation for an attack by Israel on Iran's consulate building, so like an embassy building in Syria. Mm. That happened on the 1st of April. And that attack by Israel on Iranian soil, that killed about 9 people, mostly military staff at the embassy. Mm. So because this has been framed kind of as, I think people were quite shocked about this. People kind of saw this as not necessarily as out of nowhere, but as like quite a sudden escalation. Mm. But in actual fact, Iran has been kind of signaling for the last week quite publicly what it's going to do. Like, and this is sort of a strategy that allows things to de-escalate. This is, you know, so Iran, in retaliation for this attack, they sent about 300 rockets, unmanned drones. They're called kamikaze drones because they explode upon impact. They're unmanned. And because Iran had signaled so clearly in advance to the US and to its own neighbors and allies what it was going to do, Israel had time to, you know, get everybody out of anywhere that could possibly be hit. Mm. Everybody, all the US, the UK, they were all prepared to shoot these drones out of the sky. And in the end, 99% of the drones were intercepted. Mm. So in the end, the attack, you know, kind of as always happens, the people who got injured were Bedouin children. So these would be children who are not ethnically Israeli. Mm. Bedouins are sort of a nomadic people who live in the Middle East. And, you know, so essentially, the state of Israel and Israel's defense apparatus really suffered no damage as a result of this attack.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Obviously, the fact that it's unprecedented for Iran to attack Israeli soil. So I think that freaks people out. I just think the idea of bombs dropping freaks people out. And you get a lot of talk then of World War III. Mm. And, you know, World War III starts to like trend on Twitter. But a lot of analysts do think that because of the way Iran has approached this by being very, very clear about what it was going to do, not hitting it, you know, they've injured a small handful of civilians, which is awful. But as far as Israel is concerned, they don't really have to, on a pride level, they don't have to respond. Mm. So it's kind of Israel now is in the position, the ball's in Israel's court. Mm. US has been very firm and, you know, said that Israel should not escalate this situation. But I mean, Israel has really done nothing but escalate the situation for the last 6 months.
Israel created this situation.
Yeah.
Like,
But I think this could potentially be different, you know, according to the analysts, because, you know, a military campaign against Iran, a country of 90 million people, which has an enormous standing army and has, you know, has ties to Hezbollah in Lebanon, which can also strike Israel. You know, Iran is a much more powerful foe than the 2 million you know, impoverished, starving people living in Palestine.
Yeah.
So whether or not Israel really is going to escalate this conflict, this new phase of the conflict with Iran, I think is less likely. And I think that's kind of where analysts have landed in the aftermath. But at the same time, it's all very unprecedented. So, you know, it's not as if anyone can predict what Netanyahu is going to do next. Mm. So it really is. It's a tense time and people are worried. But I do think right now, broader consensus among analysts is that the way Iran went about this was a sort of, it was, they had to retaliate to the embassy bombing, but they've done it in really like kind of the least emphatic way possible.
Yeah, it seems almost like they were trying to send a message rather than actually kind of do major damage.
Yes, it was more like, look, we're going to break the taboo of never having hit Israel before. But as you say, they're not actually, they didn't set out to do anything that would cause Israel to escalate it even further. So it's in Israel's hands. And they have said that the defense minister, or at least I think it was the defense minister, it was one of the cabinet ministers for the war cabinet, said that they would strike back at a time of their choosing, you know, when the time is appropriate. And I think that's kind of a way of, at the, you know, sort of kicking the can down the road and saying that, you know, we will exact a price. That was the phrase they used, exact a price eventually. But it doesn't really sound like right now as if, you know, Tehran is going to be bombed by Israel forces tomorrow. And it doesn't seem like the US would be prepared to back Israel if they did do that. Although, of course, much like Netanyahu has escalated everything, Biden has also up until now supported virtually everything that Netanyahu has done. So if Israel were to go to war with Iran in a more complete way, really, God, no, I really have no, I don't think anybody could say for certain what the US would do.
Yeah, but that does feel unlikely at this moment.
Unlikely. Yeah, that's certainly not what I think the people who are the experts in this field, that's not what they're anticipating.
Okay, so that's good to know. I think that's good for us all to note for now. Now let's talk about what happened in Sydney over the weekend. Really heartbreaking scenes.
Yeah, this was a terrible story, and obviously a lot of relevance for Irish people because so many Irish people are based in Sydney these days. So I think it must have been very shocking for people. Is five women and a security guard were killed at a shopping mall in a knife attack. It was a mass killing event, which really was just heartbreaking and terrifying. And you know, the kind of, it's still being parsed out now in the aftermath. I think one of the kind of sort of not necessarily side stories, but I think what added to the sort of confusion and to the fear was that there were a lot of early reports made by really high profile people that it was an Islamic extremism terrorist event. You know, you had Rachel Riley from Countdown putting this out there, and you had Tommy Robinson, of course, as he always would be, he had putting that out there. And in the end, it actually turned out to be a 40-year-old man from Australia called Joel Couchy, who had a long history of severe mental illness issues. He was renting a storage container in Sydney where he was living. And I think that's kind of as far as the police have gotten with terms to motive. So it's, you know, it's one of those awful things. It's actually particularly galling because the security guard who was killed while trying to defend other people, he was a Pakistani man himself, which I think makes the Islamophobia element of it even more horrifying.
Yeah, he was protecting people, and he had come to Australia for a new life, basically, because he wasn't safe in Pakistan. So really upsetting. He was only 30. He was described in a statement by the Ahmadiyya Muslim community of Australia as an integral member of our community, known for his unwavering dedication and kindness. He's the only male victim. And that's, for me, you know, certainly I've seen in my social media, is an aspect of the story which women are really pushing forward in Australia, the point that it was all women aside from the security guard who were killed. And if you look at the video, you can see that the attacker appears to pass men in favor of attacking women with his knife. The police in Sydney have said that they are, you know, following this as a line of investigation, which makes sense. What they actually said initially was, asked whether she believes he was targeting women, New South Wales Police Commissioner, this I'm reading from the BBC, Karen Webb, told reporters on Sunday it would be an obvious line of inquiry. She then says, you know, you can see, any of us can see watching the video, that he seems to reject men in favour of women. But she added she would not describe the stabbings as an act of terror, reiterating that police believed there was no ideological motivation. And I found this, like, that line was sitting with me because I know that the point that she was trying to make was that this was not an Islamophobic, or sorry, this was not an Islamic kind of, in air quotes, act of terror. But, you know, I'm starting to feel like these attacks on women are terrorism, and they're their own brand of terrorism, to be honest. And, you know, ideological motivation can be the kind of growing ideological motivation of anti-women sentiment that's, you know, that exists on the internet. And obviously we don't know, look, we don't know the details, but you know, there's a lot of stuff online that would lead to you to believe that there was an aspect of an anti-woman sentiment that was at the root of this attack. And I would love if that wasn't the case, but that's kind of what the conversation online is suggesting. We'll have to wait, obviously, and see what the full investigation pulls up. And yes, this man definitely, you know, experienced mental illness, it seems like, you know, for years. And that's another conversation. You know, I don't know what the mental health services are like in Australia or how well that was managed or taken care of. But, you know, it's just heartbreaking that these women, like one of the women had a newborn baby who she handed off to a stranger. And then the newborn baby had to have surgery. You know, and I think she's the name that lots of people are hearing about, Ashley Good. She was 38. She had this new baby. And I've seen lots of Australian women on social media this morning posting about those early days when you're a mother for the first time and how often you do just go to a shopping center or a shop just to feel like a person, just to like be outside of your house. And I remember thinking that the women in the booths in Phibsborough where I live were going to think that I was a shoplifter because I was in there so often, such a small shop, but just to like go somewhere and walk around, you know, it's a situation that lots of women can really identify with, that, you know, we've all, you know, if you've had a baby, you've had that thing of going out into the world just to be out in the world at that stage of motherhood. And I think that that's why so many people are connecting with her in particular. But, you know, every single life that's lost is valuable and important, obviously. And, you know, even when we talk about this, we're talking about six lives. But then, you know, we're in the midst of the conversation about Palestine, you know, where it's thousands of lives. It's, again, kind of quite stark to me that, you know, the lives of some are kind of more mourned than the lives of other internationally. But this is heartbreaking. There's no two ways about it. It's absolutely awful. We'll have to watch and see what happens. But while I was, sorry, now I'm on one. But while I was reading about this and preparing these stories for today, I obviously go through the week's news. And every week, I am shocked by just how many stories of male violence or sexual violence there are. And I just pulled together the headlines. This is just from the Journal from this week of male kind of attacks on children or women. Man who raped younger sister and brother taken into custody after sitting near sibling on train. Man who filmed himself sexually abusing baby boy is jailed for 4 years. Man who sexually assaulted 16-year-old girl on Ryanair flight handed suspended sentence. Munster abuse trial, two men jailed for rape and abuse of child relatives await decision on appeal. Sex addict nurse, male nurse, given suspended sentence for groping female colleague. Teenager sentenced to 16 months in prison for rape of young boy. Man jailed for rape and sexual abuse of two girls over prolonged periods of time. Like, those are just from this week in this country. Like, there's a problem. Like, there's a problem. And, you know, if you talk about this, you will be attacked, because to suggest that there's a male issue is a problem, because that's where the whole not all men thing comes from. But, like, there was not one story of a woman this week perpetrating that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that it never happens. We all know that it does. But when you have a situation where there's seven stories on the Journal this week, and that's not necessarily even a big week, because I do this every week and every week I'm struck by how many of them there are, we have to start looking at what is happening that means that there are so many men who feel, for whatever reason, that they need to do these kinds of things. It's not all men, obviously not, but there is a problem and we need to start addressing it directly and dealing with it appropriately, because men deserve to live lives that are better than this, than being in court for having, you know, for whatever reason, made the choice to do something absolutely terrible. Happy, healthy people don't make those choices. So men deserve better. Women deserve better. Children deserve better. We've got to face up to the fact that this is a very real social problem. And, you know, even if it's still a small minority, it's consistent enough that it needs to be dealt with, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, what could I possibly add to that, Louise? Like, I just think that covers it in such a comprehensive way. And it is such an interesting point, as you say, that when women are targeted, or when women maybe seem to be targeted, that we don't talk about terrorism, even though this, you know, there could be some kind of motive or ideological bent to it.
And there isn't always, obviously. There isn't always. But that is a growing thing that if we don't address it head on, you know, we're going to find ourselves in a very bleak space, even bleaker than we are, I think.
For sure. And we've had it because, you know, there was the 2014 mass shooting in California by Elliot Rodger.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case in Canada late last year that was the first ever time. It was a teenager killed a woman with a sword. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that an attack on a woman or a murder like that had ever been dubbed terrorism. It's like gender-based terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that steps are now sort of, I feel like the way people conceptualize these crimes is shifting a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, obviously you can see the influence of people like Andrew Tate who advance, you know, narratives of it being appropriate to use violence against women, which is just like, I mean, like, it's so crazy that in 2024 we would be talking about, that there's a popular figure who's almost, you know, a huge part of his appeal with young men is that he advances these narratives, which are criminal and awful and violent.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear teachers saying that, you know, that's who young men see as a hero.
Yeah.
And I think as long as we're living in that, just sort of it sort of feels like a tornado of, you know, the manosphere and the toxicity, that we are existing in a culture that makes women, it puts women just at huge risk of violence from men.
Yeah. Go on.
What really else is there to say on my end, you know?
Well, I think, you know, I'm it's hard to have this conversation and not hear already the criticism that you know arises from these kinds of conversations. But just in case anyone is listening to me and going, oh, typical Louise, not that they listen to the podcast, but you know what I mean. Should I clip this and put it into the world? You know, it's not just me. It's not just me because earlier this year in March, the head of the Met Police, Sir Mark Rowley, said that he felt that violence against women and girls needed the same level of funding as terrorism policing because it was such an issue. It was such a problem. It is so prevalent and women are so unsafe that it needs to be treated with absolutely the same level of seriousness. So like, I haven't pulled this out of my arse. This isn't me wanting to be annoyed about something. You know, this is a very real problem. He said, the aim nationally should be to treat it as a national security threat like we treat organized crime, like we treat terrorism. When you look at the amount of harm that predatory men create in communities and to individuals, that's what it deserves. He told the board that there are hundreds of thousands of men in Britain who are a threat to women and girls. Like, you know, that's the UK, but I don't think that we can, unfortunately, in this instance, claim to be much better. You know, statistically, obviously, there's more of them, so the numbers aren't going to be exactly the same, but it's still too much, and we need to be serious about it. Anyway, look, who knows, really, the specifics of the Sydney case? We won't know. They're still investigating it. One way or the other, we know that there was a very troubled man at the heart of this, and it is absolutely tragic that five women and one male security guard are now dead because of this man's actions. And frankly, it sounds like he deserved better care and they certainly deserved better. Okay, let's move on. We have a new Taoiseach.
Yeah, so as of Tuesday, Simon Harris is finally Taoiseach. Of course, we've been expecting this for the last couple of weeks. He was named leader of Fine Gael the weekend before last, or was it even, could even be 2 weekends ago now?
Who knows, Carl? What day is it? Like, who knows?
I know, right? Like, it's all just one big cycle of waiting for Simon Harris to become Taoiseach. Yeah, so that vote took place on Tuesday, you know, the big kind of ritual in the Dáil. His kids were there, his wife was there, parents and grandparents and his brother sitting and watching from the balcony. Richard Boyd Barrett described it as a jamboree. The Ciaran Cóirle hit back and said it definitely wasn't a jamboree, but I did love just that it was like both of them were using the word jamboree and properly getting into a back and forth over whether or not this whole ceremony constituted a jamboree. But in any case, there was lots of kind of speeches, kind of almost wedding day speeches. You know, Heather Humphreys gave a speech about how when she first met Simon Harris, when he first turned up to the Dáil, she thought he was a transition year on work experience.
Mm-hmm.
All those kind of, I feel like it was one of those, like, it was Fine Gael's big day out kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all having a lovely time. And obviously the opposition benches were not having as lovely a time. Mm-hmm. There was one funny moment when kind of, because obviously the Green Party and Fianna Fáil kind of anyone who's part of the government voted for Simon Harris. He, you know, the vote passed to make him Taoiseach 88-69. So there's about 8 independents along the way as well. But so you had people from Fianna Fáil and the Green Party, other members of the coalition, giving speeches about how good Simon Harris was, which is kind of rare. You know, you never really see that in Irish politics before, having the leader of Fianna Fáil stand up and give a long speech about why the leader of Fine Gael should be Taoiseach. That's weird. You know, that's unusual. Yeah. And then there's a very funny, you know, Eamon Ryan's speech. He got up and he was talking about how this government was it had started to, you know, ramp up its climate ambitions on combating climate change. And he said, "We're just warming up," which is the most unfortunate thing you could possibly say.
I mean, literally.
Just of the opposition bench is obviously laughing so hard. Just classic Eamon Ryan, the absolute master of the gaffe. Nobody else is doing it like him.
Honestly, like that, I feel like that's what we'll remember him for. God love him.
Oh yeah, 100%. That's all people remember Eamon Ryan for. Unfortunately, you know, no disrespect or whatever. No. But like that's, you know, that's what I think everybody thinks of when he comes to mind. But so Harris, his first week, there's been no huge bold policy initiatives or anything like that. He's not tearing up trees in that respect. He's been kind of busy doing, I suppose, what you'd expect of a new kind of world leader and getting bedded in with other world leaders. You know, he's met the Spanish PM this week. They had a conversation. They said they're going to take joint steps together, Ireland and Spain, towards recognizing the state of Palestine, which I think is something that people find very interesting. And then otherwise, he met with von der Leyen at the EU. You know, he's had phone calls with Zelensky, phone calls with, you know, kind of everybody. And that's really how he's spent his first week. I think he had to do a bit of a man of the people thing. He went to the Leinster match on Saturday. So really, it hasn't been much of a policy initiative kind of week. I think it's been more about him showing his face among the kind of people he's going to be dealing with.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think there was a bit of criticism, wasn't there, that he wasn't in the Dáil for the first day after he was made Taoiseach. Yeah. But I saw very reasonable people like Gav Riley saying that, you know, he never said he would be there. And kind of, I guess it's a thing where they say, like the Taoiseach says where he's going to be. And obviously the Taoiseach isn't always going to be in the Dáil because he has to do other more important things, arguably. And on that day, he'd been at his desk from like 7 a.m. and he was doing these kinds of things, which makes sense, particularly in the current kind of geopolitical climate. It makes sense to me that he would have to establish those relationships immediately.
It makes sense, although I would say, in fairness to the opposition TDs in this case, you know, leaders' questions does only take a certain amount of time.
Right.
You know, you could potentially set
like in.
So I think the day after, I think the big complaint was that neither Simon Harris nor Micheál Martin the Tánaiste were available.
Okay.
So I you know what? It's a tough one because meeting the other world leaders, that is essential. You know, doing leaders' questions, also pretty much essential. It kind of just gets at the heart of, like, I mean, and by, you know, you can slag off Taoiseachs and politicians as much as you want, and God knows I slagged off Leo Varadkar as much as anyone did, but it is a hard job. Like, there's not you know, there's no way we can sit back and be like, oh, it's an easy job to do.
Saying there, like, he had to do his man of the people thing and go to the Leinster match, like, you know, I'm sure he's wrecked. He probably didn't want to do that at all.
No, there's no way he wants to do that. Like, I mean, look at Simon, there's no way that man likes rugby. That guy's got to be allergic to rugby.
Oh God. Yeah. I don't
that's
know.
A joke. I'm
always overly empathetic for everyone. Like that's a criticism that I've gotten on here before, that I'm too easy on people. Cause I'm always like emotionally, I'm like imagining what they feel like, which is a problem for me in my entire life, by the way. But yeah, I can't imagine. He's probably absolutely exhausted. Couldn't be me, I have to say. Wouldn't be a job I'd be taking.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time.
For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, this next story. So many people messaged me about this over the course of the last week, and I was like, yes, 100% we're talking about this on the podcast because it is absolutely insane and unfathomable that this is still a thing in 2024, with all of the growth that we've had with women in sport, that this is still a thing is mind-blowing to me. I'm talking about skorts in camogie.
Yeah, this is so last week, it was the GAA Congress. They voted against allowing women camogie players, voted against letting camogie players wear just regular shorts. Like women footballers do and like men hurlers do and men footballers do. Instead, you know, they've got to wear skorts, which I mean, I've never worn a skort. I've seen the pictures of the skorts. But the important thing is that the players find them incredibly uncomfortable. There's been surveys done. The players have been extremely vocal in the aftermath of the vote, which carried, I think, 64%, I think, of the delegates at the Congress. And, you know, this isn't a situation where it's not as if it was only the camogie delegates who could vote. It's, you know, it was across the GAA. So
yeah, but
you're
this
talking
is,
about...
This is the thing. It's not even the players who get to vote.
It's the county boards. Yeah. It's the delegates from the county boards. So you're just looking at, you know, what's going to be in most cases... an older man or older men setting the terms for, and you know, like
there's something so gross about the idea of a board of older men being like, no, the girls have to wear skirts. Like what?
Why do you care?
Like, oh, it's so weird and gross.
It's so creepy. And so, and it's, you know, we talk about like kind of, as you said a minute ago, kind of being maybe over empathetic and having so much sympathy for people. Like, you know, you look at this and you just wonder, like, are they just these out of touch? You know, do they just not understand? You know, you kind of want to come up with a non sort of gross explanation for
it. I mean, you're trying to make it make sense. But the thing, the thing about it is, though, is that like in terms, even if we assume, and I don't, you know, that's not fair. Let's say someone, a person had a kind of gross, leery approach to this. You can still see women's legs in the shorts. The shorts are still there. They're just under the skirt. So like, I can't make sense of it. I cannot make sense of it. And like, there were two different proposals this year. So one of them was to replace skorts completely, which was 64% of them voted against it. And then the other one was to add an option of shorts.
Yeah, just even let them have it.
Just let them have the choice. And 55% voted against that. So, like, I mean, at least it was kind of close. But this should be an overwhelming thing. Like, an overwhelming amount of players want the skorts completely gone. Like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, and it's also interesting because I saw, you know, the head of Camogie Ireland came out to talk about it afterwards. And the head of Camogie Ireland is a man.
Of course.
And he was saying that there was, you know, a vibrant debate within the Congress. You know, the people spoke, you know, very passionately on both sides. And I really just would be so curious to have been, you know, a fly on the wall and heard the arguments against even just allowing the option of having regular shorts, because I cannot, you know, independently come up with a good reason. So I can't imagine what they must have been saying. You know, were they talking about tradition? Were they talking about, I honestly just don't know how they can justify making these athletes wear something they don't want to. And it's actually there were two stories about this week, because there was the, I don't know if you saw the women's US Olympic outfit was
I did yeah
put out by Nike, and it's yeah again just obscene. It's like it's like, you know, something from the Eric Prydz. You remember the Eric Prydz music video Call yeah. on Me?
Like, I don't know if you guys have seen the online discourse around some of the Skims underwear. I think Khloe Kardashian herself has said, like, how is that gonna cover my pussy? Excuse me, Carl, I apologize. But that's the situation we're in. Like, a teeny tiny sliver, high, very high leg, and a teeny tiny sliver that you're supposed to be running in. Like, what the hell? It's so, what is going on in the House of Commons? Like, I can't make sense of any of this. It's so crazy to me. It is just so crazy. And, you know, I saw that the PRO... It was quite PRO for Tipperary Camogie. Geraldine Canaan was speaking on Tip Midwest Radio. I'm reading this from an Irish Times piece by, Louise Lawless. And she was quite measured, I think. She said, disappointed would be the main word, you know, a bit surprised by the margin of defeat. We knew that some counties were in favour of keeping the status quo, but we did think that with the 120th anniversary of the Camogie Association, we've come a long way from back in 1904 when they had to wear long skirts. And we thought now is the time to join the 21st century and modernise the game. I mean, that's just it. I saw as well, Sinead O'Carroll was on, I think it was Off the Ball, talking about this, Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the Journal.ie, but lifelong camogie player as well. And she was saying... And your boss, yeah. But she was saying that she remembers, I think she was 12, and her team won a championship. And it was a big deal and they were really excited. But one of her big memories from the day is that at the time they had to wear skirts, but they obviously all wore bike shorts under their skirts because you can't play sports in a skirt and not have it be uncomfortable or distracting. And she said that she remembers that on the day as they were being handed their trophy, they were also being lambasted for wearing the shorts. They were in trouble. And the whole thing was kind of overshadowed by the shorts. Like, it's just this paternalistic, patriarchal bullshit that, and we have an issue with women stepping away from sport anyway as they get older for so many different reasons. You know, a lot of it comes down to body esteem. Some of it comes down to girls being, you know, self-conscious around their period or other hormonal changes. Like it's a very real problem. And yet we're making these kinds of decisions that just make sport feel even more kind of alienated from modern living. It's crazy. And I'm not even, yeah. I don't even play sports.
And I think a big part of the frustration now in the aftermath is that there won't be a chance to vote on this again until 2027.
2027! Like, it's crazy! I think they should all just start wearing shorts.
I think people have made that point, and I saw at least the Kerry Camogie have come out and they said they're going to back their players. Mm. I'm fairly sure it's Tipperary Camogie who brought it forth originally, so I think they'll back their players. So I think it's going to have to come down to, it should never come down to this, but I think it will come down to essentially a protest.
Yeah.
I think the players who want to wear shorts are going to have to wear shorts. And I by the sounds of it, it sounds like a popular enough motion that I think there could be enough of them that the sort of player power could win out.
Yeah. I wish I'd known to ask Hannah Tyrrell about this when I interviewed her a few weeks ago. Now, I know she plays football, but I would have been very interested to hear. I'm sure she has an opinion. I'd say there's lots of women within the GAA who have very strong opinions on this. I'd say many of them are banging their heads against a brick wall. Anyway, if you're listening, ladies, solidarity. If I can help you in any way, let me know, because this is bonkers. Okay, OJ Simpson is dead.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not laughing at OJ Simpson being dead. Just that like, yeah.
I feel like, you know, OJ Simpson has just been such a massive pop culture figure for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, God, more. I only say 30 years because that's how long I've been alive. He's been a massive cultural figure for 50 years.
And
he died this week of prostate cancer at the age of 76. I think because obviously of his decline in the aftermath of the trial for killing Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown, and then of course being found criminally liable in a civil trial, and then of course he went to jail for, you know, committing armed robbery, trying to steal back his own NFL memorabilia from his glory days, you know, OJ Simpson has not been an actual public figure for a very long time. You know, people you know, he's been on Twitter, which is freaky and weird. Mm. But like O.J. Simpson has not been he has not been welcome into sort of mainstream society in such a long time.
And definitely not in this part of the world. Like, you know, this was like, I know it was a big international story, but they stopped school to watch the high speed chase of him when they were trying to get him. Like I remember it so vividly. So it was 1994. So I was 12. And they stopped school because the teachers wanted to watch the high-speed chase. Like, we were all there in our classroom watching this high-speed chase. And they stopped school again, or, like, put on all the TVs in the classrooms. At that stage, I was a little bit older. So the TVs were, every classroom had a TV. They put it on for the whole school to watch the verdict. The only other time I remember that happening was when President Bush was announcing Desert Storm. Like, the war. So it was a really, really big thing, like a huge thing that took over, you know, people's lives and pop culture for years and years and years, and culture in general. So, you know, his significance can't be underestimated in terms of, you know, the narrative of America. It was massive.
That's it. And there are so many good resources on this. Like, there's that OJ Made in America documentary, eight-part documentary that won the Oscar for best feature documentary. And like, it is true. Like, his story is an intersection of so many different things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Race, poverty, sports, celebrity, of course, misogyny and gender violence. Mm-hmm. All of it kind of just tangled up in this one figure. And I think it's sort of something that occurred to me this week. I don't know if you agree, is that I do think that what if the world was not such a basket case right now with so many things happening geopolitically, I think we probably would have spent this whole week doing OJ discourse. You know what I mean? Like, I think that if things weren't so crazy, I think we probably would have spent our whole week, you know, parsing the sort of the different implications of OJ's sort of life and crimes and death. I think obviously it's sort of a lot of people were pushing this week as well to remember that, you know, sort of the reason a lot of people know OJ these days is because of his murder trial.
And the death of his wife.
Yes.
Nicole That's what Brown. I, yeah. And, yeah. You know,
accused of killing Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. And obviously he was acquitted, but I mean, I think there's, you know, books about this. There's a Jeffrey Toobin book about it. There's obviously the American Crime Story show, you know, the acquittal came from a lot of uncertainties with respect to police behavior, the LAPD and their sort of background of racism and racial profiling and, you know, sort of falsifying evidence against Black people. Even though the evidence against OJ was overwhelming, it was that uncertainty and that sort of fear about systemic racism that came in and sort of confused the issue. So it really just was a it's a fascinating trial to read about, and I would recommend that any. Well, I wanted to say I read an amazing paragraph from it was an obituary of Nicole Brown that was published at the time, but it was shared widely this week. And in the first paragraph, it's by Andrea Dworkin, and it said, "You won't ever know the worst thing that happened to Nicole Brown Simpson in her marriage because she is dead and cannot tell you. And if you were alive, remember, you wouldn't believe her." And that knocked me for six. And I just thought that was like very real.
Wow. Yeah. And I know that the family of Ron Goldman and stuff have been out speaking. Like, there's no comfort obviously in anyone's death ever, but I'm kind of glad that the story of OJ is over, to be honest. I'd kind of love to never hear about him again. Okay, finally, before I let you go, I just wanted to touch on Eurovision again, because as it approaches, there's been a lot more discourse online about obviously the inclusion of Israel and the expectation on contestants to pull out or not do it, or discussion of whether what they are doing is appropriate. And in fact, it turns out that a lot of people are being, you know, really harassed online, and you can argue yes or no as to whether that's appropriate. But to such an extent that the organizers of Eurovision felt that they needed to come out with a statement, didn't they?
Yeah, so the director of the EBU, which is the body that's kind of behind Eurovision, the European Broadcaster Union, he came out this week, and he issued, you know, a fairly meaty statement calling for people online not to abuse or harass certain participants. So it's a targeted social media campaign against participating artists. It's, you know, what will come. It's just it's it's very hard, I think, for anyone who exists online to pick apart between legitimate criticism and abuse. Mm. And I think that's especially tough when you, you know, this all comes from Israel's participation in the Eurovision. The reason this harassment is coming in is because you have, we talked about this a few weeks ago, you have acts like Ollie Alexander and Bambi Thug, the Irish act, who have issued a statement saying that they are going to continue their participation while sort of, you know, quote unquote, standing in solidarity with Palestine and believing that Israel shouldn't be part of it. You and I spoke, when we spoke 2 weeks ago, we talked about that there was still kind of an opportunity for them to sort of put together a meaningful protest. Mm. I saw this week, you know, Bambi Thug sharing a picture of their fingernails, and I think it was 4 black fingernails and 1 in the Palestinian flag. Mm. And I think people were really critical of that. People see that as symbolic and just not concrete. Mm. And I think if you were to go and check out that tweet, you would probably see what the EBU is referring to in terms of the backlash that these acts are receiving. Mm. It's a very tough one because you're not going to, first of all, you're not going to. And second of all, you can't really call on people to not criticize the acts over something so enormous.
Yeah.
Obviously, abuse by its very definition is bad.
Yes.
So if you're being abusive, you're That's doing something you, you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
So if you're kind of responding to these people, the contestants, in a violent way, or that, you know, that's, you know,
not okay.
And that's kind of giving and it's giving everybody a bad name, you know. Yeah. It sort of sullies the entire discourse.
I think the problem is, like, you know, a piece of their statement is, we would like to stress that any decisions regarding participation are the responsibility of the EBU's governing bodies, not the individual artists. So, like, this was our choice, not theirs. It was art, they're owning it. It was our choice to allow Israel to take part. You know, so don't abuse them for it because it was our choice. But that, I think, lays bare the entire thing. The problem is that that should never have been the choice in the first place. The EBU has put these artists in an incredibly difficult position. And, you know, I just don't understand why they don't roll back on it. It's not too late. It's not too late. Like, just tell Israel that they're not welcome in the competition this year, as you did with Russia. Like, this is the thing that it all comes back to. It's like, you've done it before. There's a template for this. You set a standard that you are now not upholding, and you are the problem. It isn't the artists that are the problem, actually, in my opinion. I think they are in an incredibly difficult position. I don't know what I would do in their position, you know? And I think none of us do, unless we were in that position. I've said it before. If you'd worked and worked and worked and worked and worked and worked and worked, you know, and then, you know, to surrender that opportunity would be very difficult, I think. And really, the EBU should man up or grow up, frankly, and follow their own standards and tell Israel that they're not welcome at the contest this year, in my opinion. Anyway, Carl, that was wonderful. Nice to have a good, diverse range of topics to discuss. Lots of things for us to get annoyed about, which is always fun.
I know, yeah. I feel like we covered, that felt like a marathon. I feel
know.
Like we covered a lot of ground.
Well, we did. Well done, you. Okay, my friend, good luck this week with your further steps towards completion of your master's. I'll be so impressed when you're all done. I hope you have a great one. Don't forget, by the way, guys, you can read Carl's weekly column, which is truly excellent, on thejournal.ie. It is Cerulean the Years, and you can read other bits of his work there as well. And he's always on the internet, guys. He's flat out. Where can the people
really
find you?
I'm always on the internet. It's a problem.
Same.
A very big problem.
Same.
But yeah, you can find me on Twitter at TV's Carl Kinsella and on Instagram at Carl.Kinsella.
Wonderful. We'll talk to you next week, Carl. Thanks. There you go. That's it now. I will be back with you on Wednesday when we will be talking about all these celebs and all of their antics. Don't forget, if you want extra content, I did record a lengthy Beyonce Cowboy Carter episode for Patreon last week, which people seem to be loving, which is, I'm so glad because it took a long time, many hours of research. But I did enjoy it. But at the end, I looked at it, I was like, it's 43 minutes of just me talking about Beyonce. Like, that does sound kind of like a mental breakdown. you know. But I promise you, it's because there's so much interesting stuff about this album. It's not actually just me kind of having opinions. It's all of the context, the little details, the Easter eggs within the album, why the songs are important, where they come from, what the references mean, all that kind of stuff. So that's over there on the Patreon. And, you know, obviously you don't have to listen to it either. If you just want to support the podcast and throw a few quid my way to keep it going, that would be great. I've just bought a new microphone, very excited about, which was funded by the Patreon. So thank you very much for that. Hopefully you'll hear some improved sound quality. I just bought one for now, but if it's good, I will buy another one because I feel like we could improve there. In my dreams, in my future dreams, I will have a house that will have a kind of, you know, like a, what do they call them? Like a glorified shed. You know what I mean? You know those things that people have in their back gardens? And I'll be able to make, like, fill it with soft furnishings and curtains on the walls and make it my podcast studio. That's my future dream. But currently we're still in a dining room, or like a kitchen dining room with hard surfaces, which means that we're compromising. But hopefully the new microphone will make it all the better. Anyway, I feel like I'm rambling. I will let you go. I hope you have a good next couple of days. I will talk to you on Wednesday. I love you. Thank you, Acast, for having me on the network. Thank you, Carl, for another great ep. And I will talk to you soon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.